Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the multi-terrain select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hey everyone, it's Kate. Mark and I are doing something a little different this week. We're handing off our feed to podcaster and host Rachel Bell of Your Last Meal with Rachel Bell, and she's doing the same for us. Personally, because of the sheer quantity of podcasts out there, I have a hard time finding the ones that suit me, and I figure I'm not alone in this sentiment, so I thought it'd be nice to share Rachel's podcast with you. It's a food podcast that I really enjoy. It's comprised of, yes, guests explaining what their last meals would be, but it's also a great interview show, which, if you're listening to our podcast, is presumably something you enjoy. Plus, it's interspersed with historical anecdotes and fun facts, which we do not do, as you know, and makes me feel like we should, because she does a great job of it. Feedback always welcome. On the episode you're about to listen to, Rachel interviews the outstanding, brilliant, and refreshing comedian Margaret Cho. It's hard to feel like I need to introduce her because she's Margaret Cho and is well known for so much. Hilariously, the thing that always pops into my mind when I think about her is the episode of Sex and the City where she plays Lynn Cameron, a fashion producer trying to get Carrie to do her show. Carrie finally agrees and then falls on the runway in a horrific, excuse the pun, fashion. And Margaret Cho drops about 80 F-bombs in 20 minutes. But she's also a social activist and an extremely successful stand-up comedian who opened for Jerry Seinfeld in her late teens. And she's acted in many of your favorite TV shows and movies, and she loves to cook. It's really hard not to like Margaret Cho, and it's really hard not to like Rachel. So enjoy this. We'd love to hear what you think. And next week, we'll be back with our regularly scheduled programming. Thanks for listening.
I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, the show where celebrities share stories about the foods they love most And we dig into the history, culture, and science of those meals with experts from around the world. Today on the program, legendary comedian Margaret Cho.
Yeah, I've been doing comedy for 40 years. And I still love it.
Margaret has countless comedy specials and albums, is an Emmy-nominated actress, and an activist. She is just about to take off on a new tour called the Live and Livid Comedy Tour, doing stand-up around the country from April through September. When you talk to Margaret about food, it becomes clear very quickly that she's a cook, she is a food lover, she loves food from all around the world. Basically, stars are just like us. Margaret is obsessed with eating. But sometimes it gets a little bit weird. Margaret shares some of the stranger things that she craves. For example, AirPods. And then we'll hear from you, my lovely listeners, about some of your favorite out-of-the-ordinary food combinations. Plus, the dichotomous world of Spam, an ingredient with a fascinating history that is equally loved and judged. All of this coming up later in the show, but first, my conversation with Margaret Cho. I've read so many things that I don't know if they are true or not about your start in comedy, like you opening for Seinfeld when you're 14 years old. So why don't you go ahead and tell me, how did you get your start in comedy?
So I was a little bit older. I didn't open for Seinfeld until I was in my late teens, but he helped me a lot in the beginning. I started doing stand-up comedy at 14, and it was through school. And I was in a theater class with Sam Rockwell, and he and I would go to the local comedy clubs and do sets as a comedy duo. So there's some footage of it on YouTube now that's really ridiculous. And we're just like babies, but he ended up moving to New York, and I stayed in San Francisco, and I just wanted to be a comedian. And I really didn't care about school or anything like that. I dropped out of high school and didn't go to college, but I entered a college comedy competition. And one of the prizes was to open for Jerry Seinfeld. So I won the West Coast region. The Midwest was won by John Glazer, who is, of course, a very impressive and famous comedian. And the East Coast was won by John DiMaggio of the amazing Futurama. You know, so we all had our own success later, but that was the famous thing where we all got to open for Jerry Seinfeld. And then I talked to Jerry after, and he said that I had a unique point of view. And if I were to continue to do comedy, I would find that I would have a very successful career. And he's been so instrumental and helpful. So I've been doing comedy for 40 years. And I still love it.
There was another contest where you won a hot air balloon ride.
That's correct. This is also in my late teens. I won a hot air balloon excursion where we were met with a terrible freak wind storm and got knocked out of the sky. And one person actually died, not in our basket, but in the basket next to ours.
What?
It ran into a big tree. Horrible.
Oh,
it was actually
God.
A horrible, horrible event. And I got dragged by my face across a cow field. But what was fortunate, it was very soft, but it didn't taste very good. And it was really traumatic, actually. It was a really nightmarish experience.
And you were on a date, weren't you?
I was on a date with a gentleman who was very chivalrous, actually, on the point of impact. He actually used his body to shield mine, and his arms actually took the blow for a lot of it, which is actually pretty incredible. You know, when we're tested at that moment of impact, you know, it's incredible what people will do. He actually really did something great. So then we went to the hospital after we got bedded up, and then we tried to have sex, which is really funny because we were really bandaged up. I never saw him again, but I think that, you know, what a great guy.
I have to say, I've learned that I am bad in those situations. One time a friend and I, we were snorkeling. We were in Thailand, and underwater, my friend was going, shark, like gurgling, like shark. I instinctively
put her between me and the shark. I tried to kill her. I tried to have the shark kill her. And I've done another thing like that too, where I'm just worried about myself under pressure that I try to kill my friends.
Well, it's not an earnest desire to kill your friends. It's really like you're just going to try to stay alive, which I think is really what we all should be doing. And so I think I respect that. I definitely don't know what I would do in the situation like that. If I'm tested, I don't want to be tested. I don't want to know what I'm capable of, you know, but that's super scary. I think any kind of snorkeling, anything to me is really very scary because you're already not really supposed to be underwater.
Yeah, just because they sell you a $6.99 plastic mask doesn't mean you should be down there.
I'm sure it's a beautiful experience, but also I'm scared.
I am too. You grew up in San Francisco. Can you tell me a little bit more about your culinary experience as a kid, whether at home or just what your family would eat in the city?
Well, we are really into foraging. My family would always go to the conservatory and the arboretums and steal plants in order to propagate them and eat them. And then we would go on specific like journeys, you know, whether it's Yosemite or different national parks, and steal plants in order to cultivate them and eat them. I have no idea what they are, but my grandparents would also make their own medicine. Hmm. They would use an old crock pot. They lived till their late 90s. And they made their own remedies for everything, which did not taste good, did not smell good. They would always be brewing something in the crock pot. So that was part of it. There was a lot of sort of like foraging, getting the plant-based cures, a lot of folk medicine. A lot of our culinary stuff was really like we're living off of the land. We had gardens in the backyard, in our front yard, which I still do now. I cultivated a beautiful crop of tomatoes and strawberries last year. And it made me feel closer to my family because that's just the kind of thing that we would do. I haven't made any medicine though.
So it's interesting because usually when you hear of people foraging, they're taking the actual food off the plant and eating that. Did your family do that or did they only take the whole plant and then regrow it at home?
No, they would only take clipping, like cuttings from plants to propagate. They would never take fruit, which I think is really, I think that's fair. You know, I also think it's fair to take fallen fruit. Mm-hmm. I think that's totally okay. I would never pluck a fruit off a vine that I did not grow myself because there's like sort of a farmer's law of like, you don't do that to other farmers. Like that's just not cool. I am super destroyed when my, you know, plants that I've been like cultivating for so long and spent so many seasons with are now finally ready to fruit and people are stealing. That's just unconscionable, especially if it's squirrels. Squirrels always love to take. Squirrels are sort of the lawless creatures. They don't care.
No, they don't care. Right now, it seems like foraging is so trendy. But when you were a kid, when I was a kid, I wonder if it was more of the immigrants who did it. Because my dad is an immigrant. And I was so embarrassed. We would go to the dentist parking lot where our dentist was in the suburbs. And they had an olive tree. And I don't think people knew you could eat the olives. I think they planted it as decoration. But we would go on the weekends and I hated it. I didn't want anyone to see me. And we'd put all the olives in a jar and my dad would go home and there'd be curing in our garage. And now I think back, I'm like, dude, I would do that, but I didn't want to do it then.
Yeah, it's embarrassing because we think I wish that I could have a real Coca-Cola in my lunch at school, but like not dried squid in my lunchbox. Like, you know, like I think, you know, there is that feeling of shame around these food traditions that we grow up with that aren't necessarily like mainstream. I mean, of course, now the culinary landscape is such that everybody wants to have that sort of real connection with that authentic immigrant lifestyle. That's like very chic. I mean, I love a home cured olive. What a treat. Yeah.
A garage cured olive. Yum.
Incredible. Incredible.
My dad would also see cactus fruit growing in people's backyards, and he would knock on the door and ask if he could harvest it. This was in a Bay Area suburb, and not a single one of these people knew that the fruit that grew on their cactus was edible. So they were very confused, but they still let the Israeli man traipse through their houses and cut off all their cactus fruits. Once again, very embarrassing as a child, would absolutely do the same thing now. All right, time for a quick break, but when we return, Margaret Cho reveals her last meal. Margaret Cho, let's talk about your last meal. What would you choose to eat for your last meal?
My very last meal, I love a spam musubi. You know, spam musubi is from Hawaii, and it's basically a way to replicate unagi, which is eel, which in World War II, the Japanese fishermen, Hawaiian fishermen, American fishermen in Hawaii were not allowed to fish. And so they were trying to figure out how can we recreate our foods by not allowing to fish. Like, that's like so barbaric to not allow fishermen to fish. So, yeah, so they started to take spam, which was readily available, and they put a similar glaze, the unagi glaze, which is like a sweet soy sauce on it, and put rice and wrapped it in nori seaweed and created a kind of a faux unagi for themselves. And then this itself became quite a delicacy and something that I really love. And now they actually created teriyaki spam. You know, the gelatinous coating, the spam afterbirth?
Yeah.
That's in there, that weird placenta.
Yeah.
That is got sort of a soy sweet base. I would also probably make a tom kha gai, which is my favorite Thai dish, which is the coconut shrimp paste soup with, I put shrimp paste in it, with chicken. I love Thai food and I have such a great appreciation for it that I won't even go to a restaurant. I have to make it myself.
Oh.
And make it the right way. And it takes a while. Like the galangal is sometimes hard to source if you're not going to specifically a Thai market.
Right.
Also lemongrass. I mean, lemongrass is more readily available, but the makrut lime leaves that I think are hard to get too. I have to go to like a Thai grocery to get all the things. And so I would probably make myself a really coconut forward, not with coconut milk, but coconut cream.
Yes.
Either that or I'll do another thing would be a mirepoix nabe, which is a Napa cabbage layered with either like really thinly sliced brisket, and like you make like packages and then you cut them so that you have this beautiful like million layered nabe, different kinds of mushrooms on top. And then I have a bonito that I'll scrape. I have the big hard tuna.
Oh, yeah. Like a big chunk. Yeah.
And I have a scraper and I'll scrape that, which makes my cats get very interested. And with the kombu, make a dashi, and I'll do that with the cassette burner that I'll put on my dining room table. Because it's something like something so beautiful, get like the nabe in the middle, the donabe in the middle of the table. Even if it's just me, to me, it's really beautiful.
I love that. I lived in Japan for a year, and that was one of my favorite traditions, was just sitting on the floor around the little coffee table and everyone eating out of the same pot. And it always seemed like one person would designate themselves kind of the leader. And towards the end, they would put the noodles in or the rice in. And I loved how in that country, when you went out to dinner, and also with nabe, someone would, this was my experience at least, when we would go out to dinner with a big group, someone would serve everyone to make sure everyone got, you know, if it was a big bowl of soup, like everyone gets a shrimp. Because, you know, I always get anxiety when you're splitting food, you know, like Chinese food, because people, they don't pay attention and they take all the shrimp. So I like the person in charge of distribution.
That's always really loving when people put food on your plate.
Yes.
You know, while eating. And that's very much my parents' way of doing things. They were like piling food on my plate, the choicest little pieces. And, you know, that's so beautiful. I think, that's a really loving gesture. But Japan is really, the food is, it's so great. And then I also love like a kombini food. I love
The onigiri.
Oh, it's so good.
It's the best.
Love it. I love it. And I love the weird desserts with the red bean and like mochi balls.
Yes, that's my favorite too.
Oh, good. Or the fish cake. Or the fried chicken. We don't have a kombini culture here, which is really sad. The egg salad, it's so good.
Oh, it's so soft on the fluffy white bread. I know you could eat a whole meal at 7-Eleven and be very happy about it.
It's so good. But I just love a lot of little things. Like I love the concept of meza or tapas. Yes. So that's my favorite kind of get lots of little things, or banchan, you know, with Korean food, all the little plates. And that's just so appealing to me.
For her last meal, Margaret Cho wants a couple of things, starting with tom kha gai, a Thai coconut soup. So going back to the Tom Kha Gai, you said that you like to make it at home and not at a restaurant. Have you not had good versions at Thai restaurants?
Of course, they're delicious, but they're somebody else's interpretation.
Okay.
Which, for my palate, it's not mine. Mine isn't necessarily good. It might not be good, but it's good to me, which is all that matters. So I love cooking for myself because I can make the food perfect, tailor-made for me, and not have to sort of think about, like, how is this properly done? Or how is this the right way? You know, it's just my interpretation and it's only for me and sometimes my cats.
I think it's unfortunate that a lot of people who live on their own don't cook for themselves. I think people think, oh, that's something to do when you're with other people or when you have company. I think people eat a lot of convenience foods and easy foods. And I'm like you, I feel like I'm worth cooking for. I love cooking. I love food. I'm going to make whatever I want, even if it's just me. I don't care how involved it is.
Yeah. And I do love a quick convenience food as well. And I'll also just really enjoy that, you know, and do it the way that I want. But I think cooking for yourself, it's the most loving thing to be your own, like, personal chef, or best is also like growing things and then eating them, you know, like that to me is like really beautiful. Like if I can in the summer have like tomatoes and basil from my garden, it's just so spectacular. So I think, yeah, you got to cook for yourself. It's not hard. Also, if you want to cook for other people, it's best to cook a lot for yourself so that when you cook for others, it's not a scary thing, not performative. You know, it's like, oh, I do this all the time, so it doesn't matter. I have like such a packed kitchen with all sorts of equipment. That's my luxury. Clay pots at the Donabis. I have a Donabi smoker. Oh, the mochi machine. The mochi machine.
You have a mochi machine?
Yeah, I have a Tiger mochi machine, which it's just really special. Yeah, I love it. I love to just cook for myself and also cook for others.
The main attraction of Margaret's Last Meal is Spam Musubi. Spam musubi is a thick slice of spam, pan-fried until hot and crispy, and basted with a sweet and savory glaze that usually includes soy, mirin, and sugar. So you take that spam that's been fried and glazed, and you balance it on top of a chunk of rice that is the exact same oval shape as the spam, and then the whole thing is held together with a thick strip of nori. I've always seen them sold as a grab-and-go item, so they come wrapped in plastic wrap. And if I am lucky enough to get my hands on some spam musubi and I pick it up and it is still warm, there is nothing better than a still warm spam musubi. Spam musubi originated in Hawaii. I'm not sure if I've had it more than 10 times, but it is still one of my favorite snacks of all time. The salty, crispy spam is balanced out by the soft, plain, warm rice. I don't care if I'm hungry. I don't care if I just ate. If I see a spam musubi and it is still warm, I am buying it. Nobody knows for sure who invented spam musubi. I tried to fact check Margaret's story, and while I did find articles about Japanese Americans being banned from fishing in Alaska and Canada around World War II, I didn't find anything about it being a substitute for eel. But there are two Hawaiian women who claim to invent spam musubi. First, there's Mitsuko Kaneshiro. She started selling spam musubi out of City Pharmacy in Honolulu. And then there is Barbara Funimura. She sold it out of Jonihana Restaurant in Kauai. It seems like both of them were doing their thing in the early 1980s. Spam was invented by Hormel in 1937, and it became really popular during World War II when it was a main ration for the U.S. military.
U.S. soldiers, they had spam with them quite a bit.
That's Robert Koo, professor of Asian American Studies at Binghamton University in New York and author of Dubious Gastronomy, The Cultural Politics of Eating Asian in the U.S.
Now we're going into the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. Spam was, for whatever reasons, a item that was really in high demand by a lot of the people who were living in the areas where the U.S. military were being set up. So it's not just the Pacific, of course. It's also in Europe. The British were very much into spam for a long time. Even the Russian armies were sharing in on the spam because the U.S. were allies. But particularly in the Pacific, different islands like Guam and Hawaii, Okinawa, and the Philippines, and Korea became the sort of the main areas where spam was embraced by the local population. Because for the local people, they were in dire poverty. And what spam represented was, number one, meat, and also that were American. And American things were seen as superior. It still is, you know, in some places.
And of course, it is beloved in Hawaii.
You know, United States, spam has had, really mixed reputation for a long, long time because it's seen as the food of the poor. In the U.S., you know, I grew up with spam as being the butt of jokes. And spam has, you know, this reputation as being a frankenfood, mystery food, you know, quote unquote, white trash. But while that's going on, I think amongst Asian Americans, you know, it was never been a food to joke about because spam was to them just something that they always had around them, was never seen as odd or unusual. I think many Americans see spam as something that is weird, off-putting, like gross. You know, I've seen many people make that face like, oh, spam, right? For most Americans, spam is mystery meat. But for many Asian Americans and Pacific people, it's miracle meat.
Everything's in perspective because, I mean, think of all the disgusting packaged processed foods that, you know, people in middle America eat, things that white Americans eat.
I've seen people who eat hot dogs would like scoff at spam, which makes right. No sense, because if you look at the label, spam is very wholesome. There's only like four or five ingredients in spam, can of spam, sodium nitrite, but that's all preserved meats have that. Compare that to, like, say, a Twinkie or like a Heitermeyer hot dog. Spam is the epitome of wholesomeness, you could argue.
You're right. I'm looking at the ingredients. It's pork with ham, salt, water, potato starch, sugar, and sodium nitrate. It is rather pure. Spam might be looked down on by some, but Hormel reports that sales have steadily climbed every single year, at least for the past 10 years. And the highest sales per capita are in Hawaii.
In Hawaii, McDonald's actually serve spam for breakfast. Two scoops of rice, put the rice in like, you know, ice cream scoop, scrambled eggs, the McDonald's style. And then you can have either Portuguese sausage or spam. But you know that in Hawaii, they also serve a version of cup ramen in both Burger King and in McDonald's.
They do?
Yeah, yeah. So you can go to McDonald's in Hawaii, order a Big Mac along a side of sai min, noodle soup. Yeah, that's my favorite, one of my favorite things.
Are there any other dishes you can think of that came out post-World War II and all these other wars you're talking about where spam just became a part of all these cultures? Are there any other iconic dishes like musubi?
Yeah, for Korean-Americans, spam has a very prominent role. Among the most popular Korean-American spam-based dish would be spam kimchi fried rice. Kimchi and spam is like a marriage made in heaven. It's just crazy how good it is. I guess the most famous sort of Korean dish that has spam is what's called pude jjigae. And pude means military base. And so it's this mishmash of all these ingredients that you associate with American convenient food. So hot dogs and spam and canned baked beans, along with like ramen noodles, go in a big pot with like, you know, Korean, you know, gochujang and other flavorings. And then you make a stew. And that's a very famous dish for Koreans because it evokes the wartime.
It's so interesting how, you know, obviously in wartime, it's terrible. And then afterwards, these dishes become beloved, even though they're from these foods that, you know, they had to eat because of rationing.
I think nostalgia is very powerful. Even if you live through poverty and war, these morsels of food that at that time was such a saving grace, right? Delicious. They remember that when you have nothing else to eat and you eat something even partially edible, is so delicious that memory of the deliciousness survives long after.
Robert argues that dishes like spam musubi or spam fried rice aren't Asian American. They are just American.
Asian Americans have been part of this country as long as any other immigrant, right? So Chinese came to America in large numbers right before the Irish or the Italians or the Jews. However, for Asian Americans, it's very difficult to be seen as legitimately American. You're perpetually foreign. And it's something that many Asian Americans of three, four, fourth generations struggle with still to this day. And so if you look at something like a typical American food, what are they? Hamburgers, hot dogs, pizza? Those all have European origins who came after, let's say, the Chinese did, right? But why is Chinese food? Things like egg rolls and wonton soup and, you know, kung pao chicken, whatever it may be, still seen as foreign. When it is as American as apple pie, right?
Which isn't American either and also comes from Germany.
Right, yeah. And so for me, spam, musubi and all spam-related dishes that Asian Americans and Pacific peoples enjoy is part of the American experience. Asian Americans are just as American as in any other American group. Plus, today, Asian food in America is so popular. Oh my God, everyone's eating it. I think to me, American food can be defined by the people who reside in this country. And American people are made up of hundreds of different languages and cultures and religions, you name it. And, you know, to me, they're all equally American.
Break time. Grab yourself a Spam Musubi. And when we come back, Margaret Cho's Strange Snacks. I heard you talking about a snack on some video series that was one of the oddest combinations I've ever heard. I was very impressed, but it started with a raisin bagel and it ended with mustard.
Oh, it's so gross. It's a raisin bagel with, I think maybe not toasted, but fresh, and with cream cheese, Doritos, and mustard. It's so gross, but there's something about it. I don't know why. I think it's just a really satisfying thing. I think with the sweet, with the mustard, and also the weird feeling of a raisin bagel as well. All of these things that are kind of very unconventional, slammed together. But I think chips in a sandwich is always a good idea. Chips in a sandwich is very, it's like, is this supposed to be here or is it not supposed to be here? I think it's really great. I don't necessarily take too kindly to fries in a sandwich. You're really taking it to the limit with the fries in a sandwich. But chips in a sandwich, I think, is great.
It's what crispy lettuce wishes onion. It could be.
Yeah, it's what lettuce should be. But, you know, lettuce has its place, too. I love a crispy fried onion in a sandwich as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A shallot.
The one place that a French fry is good, though, is in falafel. In Israel, they stuff French fries in, and that actually works well.
Mm-hmm. Or like a doner. Doner never really quite cracked America, which is so sad to me because actually I think it's one of my very, very favorite foods. And I mean, we have kebabs and we, of course, have a lot of different Mediterranean, Middle Eastern options here, of course. But
yeah, it's more of a sophisticated street food than we're capable of. We're the hot dog people.
Yeah, which I love a hot dog. I love any kind of a bagel dog. I love a Vienna sausage even. I love Spam. I love cured meat.
Do you remember back in 2018 when Cynthia Nixon was running for governor in New York? I had to use her real name, but in my house, we call her Miranda Hobbs. So Miranda Hobbs was running for governor of New York, and the press and then the entire country lost it when she was photographed ordering a bagel sandwich from Zabar's in New York City. It started off perfectly normal. There was cream cheese and lox, tomatoes, red onion and capers, but all of that on a cinnamon raisin bagel. This is when Americans start to get interested in politics. This was written up everywhere. But Miranda Hobbs said exactly what you should say in this situation, which is, don't knock it until you try it. I am a big proponent of the don't yuck my yum philosophy. Until you have tried something, don't you dare say that it is gross. It is just new and unfamiliar. I just think it is so much more fun to be curious and have a sense of humor about food rather than saying that something is gross. I got a lot of texts from people sending me the screenshot of Van Leeuwen's new Hidden Valley Ranch flavored ice cream, and I will argue to the grave that it is not gross. It is whimsical. Anyway, I was curious about the unusual flavor combinations that you love.
Hi, Rachel. This is Sarah from Newcastle in the UK. My favorite weird snack combo is baked beans with Pringles. It was discovered at the depths of a particularly savage hangover when I had nothing else in the kitchen, and put the beans in the microwave, and then I just used the Pringles basically just to shovel the beans into my mouth as quickly as possible. It's an amazing combo. Has to be Heinz baked beans, has to be plain Pringles, no flavoring, please. Although if you are feeling particularly dirty, you can melt some cheese into the beans as well. Try it, you won't regret it.
Hi, Rachel. This is James from Seattle. My strange snack came from my father's side of the family. Take a banana, slice it lengthwise, and then spread peanut butter on top of the banana, and then put mayonnaise on top of the peanut butter, and then sprinkle it with granulated sugar. It sounds really gross, but it's actually really tasty.
Hi, Rachel. This is Darren from Edmonds. My strange food combo is that I put Worcestershire sauce on my mac and cheese. I've been doing it since I was a kid and have passed it on to others, including my wife, Marty, who thought it was really weird at first, but has since adopted it for her own mac and cheese embellishment.
This is April from Seattle. And when I was in high school, I would eat a peanut butter sandwich with pork floss in it, also called rosong. And pork floss, if you've never seen it before, is basically dried pork, but it has this very hairy texture to it. It's delicious. It is a combination of savory and sweet. And I used to use just white bread, and it would have just a very lovely texture. It's very hard to describe, but I did eat it loud and proud, and I would today.
I actually feel embarrassed that I don't have a strange snack combination. Or maybe I do and I just can't think of it. If you listen to me on the radio in Seattle for many years, you probably know that I have an obsession with eating sour cream straight out of the container. Or if I'm really getting fancy, I drizzle Tapatio hot sauce on top. I also eat shrimp tails if the shrimp is fried, but these are not strange snack combinations. These are single ingredient snacks. I just really thought I was more interesting than this. You mentioned that you have a touch of pica sometimes, or pica, pica.
Yes. Yes. I want to eat AirPods. I have a hard time actually with that. I have to really think about it. Don't eat this. I'll eat it. I do think sometimes cardboard looks good to me. Sometimes also the stuffing of like my cats and dog stuffed animals, and then they like pull out the stuffing. I do sometimes want to eat that. Buttons. I've not eaten any of these things, but I have to actively say to myself when I see them, don't eat that.
Has that been your whole life?
Well, I had a thing of like eating lipstick when I was a really little kid. And I think it was just because it just smelled somehow like I wanted to eat it. And I did eat it, which is not good. I think I always have, but I've never actually indulged in it. I've never actually done it.
I wonder what that is. It makes me think of cartoons where someone's really hungry and their friend looks like a giant chicken leg.
I love that. It looks so good because the steamy lines are coming off it.
Like, yeah.
Perfectly
and, you see a button and it just looks like the most delicious spam musubi to you.
It does. Or if it's sometimes when plastic melts, I think it's going to be like creme brulee, like a melted sugar.
Yeah. It's not.
No, not good.
And that was Margaret Cho's last meal. Make sure and get tickets to Margaret's live and livid comedy show. She is visiting a lot of cities. Chances are she is visiting a city near you. Find a link to buy a ticket to Margaret's show in the show notes. Thanks to Robert Koo, professor of Asian American Studies at Binghamton University and author of Dubious Gastronomy. And if you want even more spam, go back to my episode with Keiko Agena, Hawaiian native and Gilmore Girls star. Thanks to all the listeners who shared their snacky stories. My apologies if you did not end up on the show, but I put the call out on Instagram. I sent out a request in my newsletter. So if you want to participate in future shows, make sure you're subscribed. Just go to rachelbell.substack.com. It is completely free, but if you are feeling generous, you can donate to the show there. Your Last Meal is a Slide Down the Dinosaur Media production, created and produced by me. This episode was mixed by everyone's favorite fisherman, Randy Torres. Theme music by Seattle's own prom queen. If you're not already, make sure you're following along on Instagram. I'm Hello Rachel Bell. And please subscribe to the show, rate the show, review the show. All of those things are free. They only take a moment, and they really do keep the show going. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal. In my next life, I'll be one of those people who has a treadmill desk,
okay,
which I think makes you look like a real ding dong, but probably feels pretty good.
Yeah, maybe. I see people in the offices with that. I'm not sure I can go that route.
My favorite one is about the Faye yogurt, because the first line is, well, that was a much looser yogurt than I signed up for.
Hold up.
Thank you all for listening to today's Feed Drop with Your Last Meal with Rachel Bell and Rachel's guest, the one and only Margaret Cho. You can follow Rachel on Instagram at Hello Rachel Bell. Bell has an E at the end. And Twitter, I'm Rachel Bell. You can follow Margaret Cho on Instagram at Margaret_Cho, C-H-O, and on Twitter at Margaret Cho. Margaret's also on tour right now, and you could find details about that at margaretcho.com. Thank you again, and we will see you, hear you, talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.